Hi everyone. I'm gonna start because it's already 12:30. So, hi. It's good to see you guys all here with lunch boxes this time, having a good time. My name is Ray. So I come from Rican, and today I talk a little bit about myself, but also a little about science in general. So, my English might be kind of fast, so if you ever, you know, don't understand, just raise your hand and tell me, just like, stop, you know. So, and I can also explain things, like, slowly, too, okay? So, good to see you guys out here. This is like my fourth time here, maybe. I've been here a few times, so, 日本語はまだまだですけど. Okay. So, what am I going to talk about today? So, today I start with basically why we do science, and I wanted to give a quick cautionary story about science, and how science is not always this perfectly objective standard that if you see on the news, it sounds like it should be. But it's not always like that. Sometimes it's wrought with certain biases and also certain subjectivity that I just wanted to talk about and caution you about. And then I want to talk about how I got into science, and as an example of how your own personal life actually affects the way you do science, the directions I was going, and the positive aspects about the life, the life's journey have on your scientific career as well. And then finally, I want to put those two things together, both the cautionary aspect and also the fun aspect, put that together and give you some ideas about like where to go from here. And I want to really talk with you as well and have a discussion with you about what you guys want to do, if you want to study in America or if you just want to go to America for fun, you know. Anything is cool. And the reason my talk is called iResearcher, I'm actually taking inspiration from this novel by this well-known science fiction writer. His name is Isaac Asimov. And so basically he wrote a book called iRobot. And in that book, basically he talks about how do you design a robot that is also going to be helpful to mankind. And he came up with some rules that says basically that robots should not harm human beings and they should also try to survive on their own if they don't violate the rule that they don't harm human beings. So taking inspiration from that, I wanted to talk about what we can do as researchers, because now we go into a new world, just like a robot will be in the, whatever, 24th century, right? So the question is what we can do, starting from scratch as researchers. This is what we should do, and this is what we can take out of it. Okay, so first, the more cautionary aspect. So I want to say that actually the reason that I'm here to talk to you about this is because I feel like our careers actually matter in terms of the science that we're doing. And here's some of the reasons why. Because this is what can go wrong if the life aspects of non-science things go against the science. So there's an example. His name is Trofim Lysenko. So this is from, you know, the 30s and 1940s and what was known as the Soviet Union. So he came up with this theory where in order to increase the amount of yield that he can get from planting wheat in the Soviet Union, what he would do is he would put the seeds, he would tell people to put the seeds in this very cold area for a while, and then expose them to humidity, so high number of kind of amount of water. And this process, which is called vernalization, after you treated the seeds this way, you now plant these seeds, and what he claims is that you get a lot more produce, right, out of it. Not only that, but he claimed that you only need to do this once,
Because once you do this once, the seeds somehow learn that, you know, they're going to be more hardy. They're going to be more resistant to bad weather. And then from here on, it's just, you just carry on that trait with you. So those of you who are, who know genetics, know that this is basically non-Mendelian. This is not the accepted view in kind of Western science, that you can just carry on traits that you just learn without changing the genes at all. Okay? Now, this theory normally could be easily proved to be false, right? If science was the scientific method, the appropriate scientific method was used to figure out how this actually works. But here's where the non-science part comes in. The scientist was part of this, you know, regime in the Soviet Union, ran by this kind of leader. His name was Stalin. And then Stalin, you know, had the control over the political and also in some aspect the scientific culture, right, of Russia. So Lysenko would do things to confirm his theory instead of to try to show that it could be wrong. So for example, he would give questionnaires to farmers, right? So think about how flawed this theory could be, right? You give them this seed idea, you know, you do the vernalization, they plant the seeds, and then afterwards you just ask them what they think. Like, do they get more or do they get less? Well, guess what? The government always wants more, right? Because if you get less, that means you fail, right? So he consistently got bigger yields because farmers would tell them that they got better yield. Meanwhile, like famine, right? The 1930s, 1935, 1936, famine throughout Soviet Union. And not only that, but the people who were actually into the Mendelian genetics, people who believe that the Mendelian, your kind of the accepted view today, people who believe that got imprisoned because, you know, Lysenko goes and rallies against them. Stalin sends out the police. They get sent to, like, Siberia. They have to do hard labor, right? So clearly, here's a scientist that wasn't actually doing science, even though he was claiming to be doing science, right? So this is one reason that we have to be very careful. Like, when we just say science, like, in the news, oh, this is great. Like, we look at all this stuff that's being accomplished. We're building all this stuff. Well, let's step back and be careful and evaluate what people are saying. Let's evaluate the data, see how they arrive at the data before we can conclude this is good science. And similarly, this is the second of two examples I give you just on the idea that the science really depends on the scientist who's actually doing it. If you thought the first example was like crazy, oh, this is not going to happen again, right? This is just some mirage that happened long ago in the Soviet Union. Well, here's another example that's much more subtle, like female, okay? But it's showing similar things, right? So here's a study. A psychologist named Peter Watson, what he did was he gave people three numbers, right? And there's a rule governing what whether it's positive or negative, whether these three numbers satisfy a certain rule. Okay? So for example, if he gave you 2, 4, and 6, then he said yes, it satisfies the rule. Then he asked the participants to start coming up with a theory of what the rule is, right? So for example, if I ask somebody, then somebody says, well, how about 315? Does that satisfy the rule? And the answer would be no, that does not satisfy the rule. Okay? So the participants are free to choose whichever number they want. Right? Any three numbers that they want in some sequence or order. Right? So, and the experimenter will just tell her whether it satisfies the rule or does not satisfy the rule. Now, when you do this experiment, what do most people do? Most people that do the following. They saw those numbers and they say, what about 248? Does that satisfy the rule? The answer is yes. Then they say 8, 16, 24. Does that satisfy the rule? The answer is yes. But what you notice is that they're actually giving the same types of numbers that they started with. So basically what people find is, in this study, is that actually what people do is they come up with a theory. The theory was that, oh, it's probably increasing even numbers of some sort. Okay? Then, in order to test that theory, they give the positive examples, right? So instead of saying, giving the example of 2, 3, 4, they tend not to do that. They tend to do the 2, 8, 16, you know, 2, 4, 12. Because guess what? Those are the examples that allow them to confirm their theory, which was that they were just even numbers that were increasing. So it's not just for this rule. I know this sounds kind of complicated, but the general idea is that it turns out even when there's other rules, people, if you look at this circle, what people do is people try to find things that are in their hypothesis. Okay, in this, sorry, this mouse. So in this inner H group that they're trying to test, instead of finding things that are in the T, which is the actual truth, that are not in the hypothesis. So what you notice is that actually it's a very subtle thing. People are trying to do science, right? They go, okay, how about 212.84, right? Yes, it satisfies the rule. People are trying to do the science, but actually in a very subtle, bemeal way, they're actually not taking advantage of the entire possibility of science, which the most powerful aspect is being able to falsify, being able to say that your theory is wrong. Because if you cannot say that your theory is wrong, then basically your theory is useless. And it turns out in the experimental setting, this is what most people do. They try to just verify, oh, is this right? Oh, I must be right. This is what people do, and it's called confirmation bias. So, and we have to be careful of that, right? So this is a little bit more subtle than this example, right? This was cultural and social, but this is embedded in our mind. There's something in the human mind that makes us very susceptible to biases, even when we think we're doing science correctly. Okay. So now that's kind of the sort of negative aspects, right, that I wanted to caution against. But what about the positive aspects? There's also a lot of things that influence you that make you want to do better science. There's also a lot of things that in your life that makes you want to pursue science in a different way. So here's some of the influences that I can think of that influences science, and hopefully it will help you as you go on to your future, right? So number one is motivation, right? It's like, oh my God, this is so interesting. That snowflake, the way that, you know, the math can describe this very intricate pattern, you're intrinsically motivated. And that has nothing to do with the science method itself, but it's something that comes from outside that pushes you to do something, right? There's also metaphysical. For example, if, you know, you believe in a certain deity and a certain elegance in nature, that pushes you also. Now, on the other hand, there's also practicality, right? If you don't have a certain powerful enough laser, right, you can't do a certain type of experiment. If you can't push the particles to go fast enough, you cannot test certain theories in physics. So there are limitations there, there's some things that you can't overcome, even though theoretically you want to test your theory. And so kind of the high energy physics has to deal with this problem. Right. There's also cultural, right? So there's a lot of people doing research that actually come from, you know, things from science fiction, right? So like people write novels about, you know, being, you know, like Google Glass, you know, got that kind of thing. And also, you know, like Star Trek came up with ideas like wormhole, and then the physicists kind of look at that and go, oh, wouldn't that make a great theory? So the science fiction and the culture also affects how we going to do science, or at least push science in a different direction. There's also this bias to have consistency, and you see this as physics as well, right? Because people want grand unified theories of everything, because you want everything to be consistent. Why would the universe be, you know, one way here and another way in a different area, right? And that affects biology as well. Why would the circuit work this way in this part of the brain, but work in a different way in a different part of the brain? There's also controversy that affects things. Like, for example, when you have two groups of scientists who are adamantly against each other, well, a lot of times they're not really looking for the truth. A lot of times they're looking for bits in the world that can contradict the other person. Right? So you can see that that's not objective science. That's just coming from the culture. There's also perspective, and this is something I will talk about in my own research as well, is that there are scientists who are more biologically, for example, minded, and there are those who are more social science minded, and there's also those who are more mathematical and computational minded, and they don't think the same way. A biologist will ask you, why are you building a model? Like, it contains everything that I already know about everything, right? Meanwhile, the computational person will say, why are you looking at the slight specific detail of the neuron? We know that when you put all those neurons together and integrate it, they do exactly this. You know, my model predicts it, right? So you have contrasting perspective on things that also, you can't really say that they're against science, but it's something outside the science that you have to remember. Right? You have to think about when you're actually doing the specific science that you're doing, I feel like. Okay. Now, you can come into your own conclusions, of course. So these are some of the things that can affect science. So the next part, I wanted to talk about my own research, because I guess this is why I'm here. I'm supposed to talk about my life and everything, right? But I want to put it in the context of how it has changed me, and also how it has led me to pursue different things in science. And you can see maybe, hopefully, some of the positive aspects about influences on science as well, that it drives you to do, try to understand different aspects of the world. So, quick switch, random switch, to something completely different. So, I just want to tell you briefly about what I was doing. A little bit. So I actually started, in high school, I actually was always interested in psychology, right? I was also interested in how people think. And that really comes from a deep, like, need to understand yourself, right? Because I always thought, like, physicists and chemists, they can study, you know, atoms and particles into very, very specific detail if they want, but ultimately they can't understand themselves. And it's themselves that's actually driving what they're doing. So it's kind of related to this lecture in that way. To understand yourself is the most kind of fundamental thing that was lacking, I felt. So initially, though, when I came and did my college, actually this was slightly before college. This is like a year before college, or the summer before college. I was always like have aptitude in math. So this is kind of the point number three, right? Practicality. I'm good at math. Let's do something math related, right? So I got into engineering because I was good at making things, you know, making circuits, things like that. First job I ever got is this place called Hughes Research Labs. It's in Malibu. It's like overlooking the beach, you know, like they're in Los Angeles, Sunset Avenue, Malibu. If you imagine that. If you've ever been to Los Angeles, that's what it was like doing internship there. It was great, right? So we were building the software to visualize kind of a battle environment for the army, basically. I don't even know if I'm supposed to tell about this, right? I might be forbidden by the U.S. Army to talk about this, right? No, it's okay. It's okay. And then I was building things, and, you know, the thing I got from that was that actually when you're building software, you're actually trying to mirror the way you think in categories. So people don't say this, but actually what I talk about for me, you make these diagrams on the left here to tell you what piece of the software to put where. Now, officially, it's to actually help you you know, organize things, right? If different team members are doing different parts. But actually, a lot of it also is to organize thought. And that's what one of the things that I got from that as well. So it's kind of related to the neuroscience I was doing. And then the other thing I was doing that summer, I was doing at UC Riverside, this robotic search and rescue, right? So basically, we help build a robot and you work as a team. This is really fun because, you know, one person would kind of build a camera, another person would, you know, help build a motor that the robot moves in. And I was in charge of the integration, which is great because I realized I was the only one doing the real robotics, which is the software to the algorithm for how the robot actually learns in the environment. Because basically you have this maze and then the robot kind of goes through this kind of a state space maze. It's not important exactly how it works, but once it finds the person that they need to rescue, then you start the trial again and you look for that person again. And it tries to learn the optimal way in order to rescue that person, right? But it turns out, I mean, it's learning using computers what the human being can do naturally, right? So again, it's something that I took away from that. Even though you're doing engineering, it matters what you yourself as a scientist thinking about. Because if you think about it in terms of the psychological and brain science aspect of it, it's actually doing neuroscience. Okay, so that's culture number one, engineer. And then I went to undergrad, and then in undergrad days, I got this great opportunity to go to UC Berkeley, but also one of the kind of well-known research centers in the world. So it's called Palo Alto Research Center. Maybe, like, you guys might be too young to know this, but Palo Alto Research Center, one of the kind of the fun things they always claim, you know, the first day I walk into work, right, they go like, this is Palo Alto Research Center. We invented the Ethernet, right? That was their thing, right? So hopefully you guys still know what Ethernet is, right? You know, because everybody's saying Wi-Fi, right? The Wi-Fi, I don't know what Ethernet is. That, you know, that cable that goes into, it's just that cable. That cable is called Ethernet. But they didn't invent the cable. They invented the system. The idea of connecting everything into internet, but then they came up with the standard with which you do that. Now, they did a lot of other things, too. Basically, it was also where they invented the first object-oriented programming language. Okay, it doesn't mean anything to you, maybe, but you know, how to build software in a module way. They also came up with that, scientists there. But the main thing, though, is that the scientists there, unlike every other place that I've been, actually, still, to this day, is that they are totally unmotivated by kind of money and kind of the external things. They want to build things that make humanity better. I mean, it really is a lot of fun. And to have the discussions with the scientists there, I would say mostly computer scientists, right? So at this point, it's more the computer science aspect of it. So there I got to build this thing, which is it's basically how to get computers to visualize environments, just like humans. It's called computer vision. Basically, that you show a movie, and at the beginning of the movie, you have a person walking around, right? And the goal of the computer is to track that person as it moves around. Very simple, right? Human being, very simple. If I'm walking around right now, you guys are, your eyes are tracking me. See, I can see that, right? You can tell where I am in this video, right? Okay, the same thing, you give it to the computer, right? So now the computer's in the back taking a movie of me, right, walking around. They got no problem. He's here. Well, boom, he's gone. Where the heck did he go? I don't know where he went. Oh, well, I still don't know where he is. So the other answer. Computers are very stupid. That's my point. Once you go behind the desk, the computer's like, I have no idea what happened to this guy. His lower body disappeared. Okay. So that's the kind of things you learn, right? So in that environment, what you learn is that, wow, like, when we doing things as human beings, like being able to just see something in color, oh my God, actually you appreciate the very, very trivial things in life, right? Being able to taste an apple, you know? I mean, these are, computers can't do that, right? And so what I took with is how important computer science is, actually, right? And biologists, actually, they kind of just, oh, computer science, they're just trying to build stuff that we never need. But if you actually do the computer science, you realize they're trying to do something really difficult. And the algorithms that I was learning to write up in the software was very complicated. I don't want to bore you with the details right now. But basically, they rely on this area of science called statistics, which is you're never really certain about something. You always have knowledge about things in probability. So what that means is that instead of being sure about some specific thing, you're only sure that it's a distribution. You know more or less that person is just about there, and the distribution about how big his arms or how fast his arms are moving, you kind of know, but you never know for sure. Because whenever that changes, you want to be able to update your knowledge. Yeah. So that's what I took from that. And biologists don't think this way, because biologists think it's either this or that. That cell is either going to fire or it's not. There's no probability associated with it. But if you integrate over all the cells, then you come up with probability, because every cell behaves a little bit differently. So that's the second example of how culture influences science, although it's my own example. Here's number three, right? I'm also actually almost there. So then I went to UCLA to do grad school. So why did I do that? So at Berkeley, I was doing all this science and engineering stuff. I actually got interested in psychology, and in particular called functional imaging, which is how you visualize the human brain during certain activities. So I just went into the professor's lab and just say, like, can I just be your slave, please? In order to learn, right? I give my labor in exchange to learn everything in their lab, right? So anyways, he was good enough to write me, you know, a letter for grad school. I didn't have any expectations, actually. So what that means is, like, when I applied to UCLA Neuroscience, I have, like, one and a half neuroscience-ish experience. And even then, it's not very neuroscience, more psychology. But at that time, they just, like, you know, we did the interview, and then, you know, if you're interested in how you do an interview, if you ever want to study in America, we can talk later. But it doesn't depend on your scores. Your test scores and stuff like that doesn't matter. It's about what you did and what you can communicate. That's really what matters. So anyway, so I was lucky enough to get into UCLA. While I was there, I decided to, basically, I really wanted to do physiology, which is how individual cells are doing things, right? Because I felt it's kind of a compensation from before also. Before, I was looking at these big circuits and systems, right? Both from the psychology and from the computer science. But now I went the other way. I was like, well, I don't know how it really works in the real live tissue. Give me a live mouse, which I can then sacrifice and do experiments. Okay? So I want to do physiology. But the first thing I did there was actually I went and did even lower than that. I went to do molecular biology. And those of you who have done it before, you realize it's, you know, it's a little bit more complicated. So there, the first thing I did this kind of, as you guys all probably done before, PCRs, right? So in this case, we were doing this thing called yeast-2 hybrid assay. Basically, you're just trying to see which proteins interact with which. In the fly, by the way. This is a fly lab. And I got the techniques of it. I found it interesting. I found it amazing that even flies have, like, thinking, quote-unquote, ability. They're not thinking like you or I, but they react to the environment in specific ways. In this case, actually, we were looking at temperature. So that was pretty amazing. But following that, though, I wanted to do some sort of real physiological neuroscience. Right? So the first, you know, the last lab that I got into, and it became the lab that I eventually joined, was this lab which worked on basically movements. So how do you control movements, right? So in animals, in this case. But they do it in the context of a circuit. So how does this circuit in the brain contribute to movements? And in particular, specific cell types. So what we did there is we cut up little slices from the brain. We take that out. And then I found this kind of definitely very specific effect in which a neurotransmitter, which usually is inhibitory, turns out to be excitatory. I mean, the short answer is I found something very, very specific in some very specific part of the brain that does a certain thing. But it's really important because if you look at the papers that came later, they actually thought, well, okay, this is interesting that you can actually get this effect. So anyway, the short answer is basically you put some dye into this tissue, and then you're able to measure when the cells are firing, basically. In this case, it's actually the axon, so there's actually the fibers of these cells, so how the fibers of the cells are firing, and then you put on a drug and you see how the firing changes. In fact, in this case, it's how the speed is actually going to slow down or increase. Right. So very specific circuit, and actually, towards the latter part of the graduate study, I already went and started trying to think about how to integrate things. So this is a slide from my dissertation, actually. And so what I did was that there was kind of three level aspects of the study that I was doing. So one is what I was telling you. You put a dye in the tissue, and you measure the velocity with which the signal is flowing through this circuit. Okay? You can also do that in a different method using lasers, basically, and you become much more precise at being able to control when you put on something, as opposed to the drug, which just kind of takes a long time. But then in an attempt to integrate this, I also build a model using this software called Neuron. So this is a software that allows you to build this, in this case, is a single cell, right? Now, in this technique that we were doing, we did not have ability to actually get single cell fibers in terms of being able to measure them. We were not able to do that. That's not anybody can do that very easily. So this is kind of the practical limitation. But using computational models, now you can partially overcome that. And you can say, well, if my model looks this way, what would happen if we did an experiment in the software that we never are able to do in the actual slice, right? So we actually found something in the model that predicts a certain type of curve that it has to have for the certain channels which are in this slice. Okay, it's kind of complicated, but we used that, and we go and look back in the literature, and we found, actually, people found that as well, that these different cell types, whether you predict that you can have this effect or not. The short answer is that basically using the model actually allowed us to figure out what we need to look for and also made predictions about what could and could not be true. Right? So for me personally, the model helped a lot. Right? It doesn't always help, right? So some people just think models are for, you know, anal intensive people who wants to code every day, right? And that they're not making predictions, and it's also difficult for you to make predictions on a model as well. So that's, you know. Anyways, that was an attempt to do it, and that was an attempt to bring things together. And then after that, so for my postdoc studies, I actually wanted to do more behavioral stuff. So this is more the circuit and about cell types. And after that, though, I wanted to actually look at the behavior in the animal to understand how the behavior works and then whether we can build
models of that as well.
So that's kind of what I'm working on now, although I am writing the paper now. But so in the Riken Brain Science Institute, I can't tell you like too much about specifics because it would take too much time. But basically, we work on this behavior in which if you give a tone to the animal, and then you give some sort of stimulus. So for example, a shock or food, you know, either positive or negative. In this example, I'm giving you shock. If they give them shock after the tone a few times, all of a sudden, the next time the tone comes on, the animal will exhibit freezing, which they go like this, right? So it looks like this. It looks like, so the first time they're in the cage, they hear dee, 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 oh, shock, right? And they're like screwed up, right? But then they go, okay, maybe it's okay. Maybe it was just some random thing that happened. And then they walk around a bit, and a minute or so comes, and they go, beep, 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 ash, again, right? Second time, they're like, oh, shit. Something's going on. This is exactly this is what it looks like, right? They go like this, and they freeze, right? Because the next day, you put them in that context or a different context, a different box altogether, right? A different environment, and you give them the tone, right? They're walking around, they go, oh, new environment, cool. Maybe it's good, maybe I can find some sweets. They freeze, just like that. So what's going on is that they're learning. They're learning the idea that the tone is predicting the shock. So originally this, as some of you might know, was with, you know, other animals. For example, dogs, right? So you have a dog or a cat, right? If you remember that sound of opening the can with the food, right? Oh, right? They come out, they go, they know the food is coming. They don't even need the smell, although the smell is going to help them eventually. But this is what animals and humans do all the time to learn. Now, I'm not saying this is exactly what I want to study. I want to study how animals, you know, lick food, right? But it's a circuit that allows you to go into more depth, right? So basically, if you use the circuit, we did a bunch of work. Too much detail to go into, but the general idea is that we find this single system in the brain, which is actually dopamine system. Depending on where the projection goes in the brain, they actually do different things, right? Because when you manipulate this the system in different areas where they terminally project, then you actually get opposing effects on how well they learn to fear and also get rid of the fear. Getting rid of fear is also really important because really you want to actually, as a model for rehabilitation, for people who come back from the war, for example, how to stop them from being afraid. And that's actually really important. And we find that this system, depending on which pathway goes where, is actually important. So it could be helpful for medical purposes or medical research. So anyway, so that's what I was doing in my free time doing science. And so, you know, I just wanted to give you a little break, show you kind of the various stuff I was doing. I feel like my path through it is definitely unique in the sense that I was going through many different perspectives, right? The most important thing, though, that I can take out of it is that what I can say is that if you go in there and be a computer scientist, or if you go in there and become a biologist, whichever way it is, you have to really, really become that person, right? You cannot go to the biologist and just take your computer science stuff and just go, oh, let's just do this and this and this because I know how to do this in computer science. That's not how you really learn. The way you really learn is you go in and you learn the behavior and attitude and thinking of the people around you who are doing, for example, physiology, right? In the back of your mind, you're still like, wow, I learned all this other stuff. I'm just not, you know, I'm not using it at this precise moment. But in the back of your mind, you're always keeping track of the whole world because you have your whole life in front of you and behind you, and that whole life is going to help you. But in order to really, really become that, you know, medical scientist, for example, if you have to do a residency, you go in there and you do it just the way, you know, the way they're trying to work. Because you know what? They've been doing it for like 20, 25 years, whatever it is that your teachers or your colleagues are doing. You learn from the best, and then you say, I'm going to take the best, and I'm going to use what I know also to form a big story, or to form a bigger general idea of how things work. And I feel like that is a good way to go if you're not sure. You know, if you're not sure, then you go in and learn the best you can, and then you come out and you say, what can I take from it? So that's my advice. Hopefully it works. Okay. So in conclusion, because I want to give you guys about 15 minutes for questions. So here's some things kind of in conclusion that I wanted to say from what I was talking about in this talk. So for one thing, in science and also social science especially, there's always interpretation, right? If you look at the data, especially in social science, because in social science, it's hard to do control experiments where you have one that has treatment and the other one that does not get the treatment. You don't always get that. Usually you get surveys or you get data that says something correlated with something. So you're never really sure. And so interpretation is almost impossible to avoid, right? So really, for that case, it really does come down to the scientists. You have to really be unbiased in the way that you interpret the data. You have to make sure the fact that you were brought up a Democrat or Republican does not influence how you interpret the election data, for instance. Right. But as I showed in this talk, in science also it matters which direction you take your research. Why do I want to look at that circuit and not this circuit? Well, part of it is practicality, right? I was able to dissect that circuit because we have the tools to do it. We don't have tools to do this other thing. But notice that that's not science. That's just something that's outside influencing the science, right? So even in science, that kind of very subtle bias is possible. And this is why in science, actually, a lot of times, and I'm not saying this is bad, but a lot of times when we're writing papers and things like that, especially in America, I say, we even say in the language, we want to tell a the story, right? That's not just because we're using that as a metaphor. That really is, you have all the data in front of you, and you kind of group and select, okay, this is important, and you... Sometimes even consciously, unconsciously, you're selecting information that you feel is important. What do I put as figure one? What do I put as figure two? Right? That there's a selection there. Most of the time, you want to say this is number one because this is a significant data that people have not found and we found it's important. But there could be other biases in terms of how you select that. Right? So I just want to say everybody should be careful when they're actually doing the science. Because it's always subjective in a sense. Science is not a wholly objective, perfect box that you can just use. It's not like that. It's always in the context of human beings who are actually doing the science. So next thing is kind of what I said. Why do we go a certain direction? Because we find it interesting, or is it because we find it feasible, right? That it's possible to do. There was also a study, actually a big study recently about how SAT testing, so this is how in America, this is how you get into college, right? So instead of the system here, what they do is everybody takes the SAT test. And this group actually, the SAT, they show that they have a lot of hidden biases that were specifically against certain ethnic groups and genders, right? So when they did the statistical analysis, they found that this was a significant thing. It's still controversial, but if you notice, if the test itself is already very subtly biased in certain ways, how can we be sure that science, the thing that we think is absolutely perfectly bulletproof, is also not without biases, right? I didn't I didn't have a chance to go too much detail into Japan versus US, but as some of you know, there are differences in the lab culture as well, right? Like some Japanese, certain Japanese ideas about, oh, you have to do this certain thing a certain way, but US, maybe they would take you to different directions. So that's also something that influences the science that you do. So basically, I guess what I'm saying is that actually, I think of the scientist as really kind of a writer who's trying to make sense of everything around them. And sometimes they get this information, sometimes they get that piece of information. She's trying to stay objective, but ultimately, she has to realize that she has to do the best she can, remain as unbiased as she can, but meanwhile interpret all these beautiful things around them, and eventually make something out. Okay. So in very conclusion, I want to go back to the iRobot story I was saying, and then I'm going to open up to questions. So in this novel, Isaac Asimov, who's a really famous science fiction writer, he came up with this like three laws of robotics, right? So first, the robots should not harm people. That's number one. That's why you make robots. Then they say, well, okay, you have to obey humans unless it conflicts with harming other humans. So you always do not harm humans. And then the number three thing is like you protect yourself. As long as you're not harming humans and you're obeying humans, right? So taking kind of inspiration for that, I came up with this like kind of three laws of research, right? I researcher. So first of all, the most basic thing is you always try to do unbiased, controlled research as much as you can, right? Social science, that could be difficult, but in science, that is the gold standard. And then you always try to obey the scientific method as much as you can, right? Unless there's bias in it within the scientific method. But then the last part, the fun part, go out and do really what you want to do. Go out and really enjoy the world and take in what your interests are. Because that's what I did. I went out in there and I said, wow, this is cool. I'm going to look at movements. I'm going to look at dopamine. As long as you're not doing biased data and you're using the scientific method. Okay, so that's kind of my fun, kind of Jodan way. It's not Jodan, but funny way to summarize what we're looking at this lecture. So anyway, so I wanted to give you guys a chance to give questions. So hopefully you enjoyed certain parts of this talk. And if you want to ask me about anything, I'm totally happy to discuss that with you. Anybody want to ask me a question? Yes.
As you said that culture influences the science, how can I realize that what I am believing and stop doing the wrong way? Is it that just be careful not to do such a thing?
Yeah, so you're asking like basically how do I do what I was saying, right? Actually, to be honest, I give you the answer, and the answer is that actually, you cannot avoid biases. I don't find that I can ever completely avoid biases. I just think that the number one thing is you realize that it exists. So the fact that you're sort of thinking about it in this way is very, like, that's the solution in some sense, I feel like. Because once you know it, then you can recognize and see whether it exists in the world. But in terms of like the specifics, oh, there's just so many studies out there. So the confirmation bias study that I was talking about, you can look into that with Peter Watson. And also there's a follow-up study on that by Clayman and Ha in 88, I believe, on that specific aspect. So when they do the confirmation bias study, they also find, well, maybe it's just inability to generate negative hypotheses, right? So they actually go in and use a statistical model to analyze how that could be occurring as well. So if you want to look at that aspect, like the specific technical aspect of how the psychology of the kind of biases we can make work, then I recommend looking at those studies, looking up confirmation bias, looking up consistency bias, work by, I can't remember the person's name right now, but basically conflict conflicts of interest, that types of work. In terms of the society, though, that part's difficult. I mean, what is the society training me to do? That's difficult. I mean, that maybe you go to America and you look at the way they do it there, and then you come back here and you say, well, how do they compare? What are the biases in America that maybe in Japan was never an issue, or maybe there was biases in Japan that Americans never thought about? Yeah, I don't have an answer for you, actually. But given that you bring it up, that's really good. That's a really good sign for me. Yeah, thank you. Any more comments? Yeah. Cool. Well, anyways, I'll be up here if you guys want to talk more.